Reformed Christian politics. What is it? Well, we're going to find out. I'm George Sayor, a pastor in the PCA, a host of Grace at the Gates, but also a contributor to the EM Network, Eschatology Matters Network. And why that's relevant to this conversation is because I had these three gentlemen on, Stephen Wolfe, Zachary Garris, and Sean McGowan, authors of Reformed Christian Politics, and what was supposed to be like a 45-minute episode, which is kind of what I do, it was two and a half hours. So I didn't want to run the whole thing on Grace at the Gates, so I figured I'd run half there and half on the EM Network, on Eschatology Matters. And it's not there's not going to be a whole lot of overlap. There'll be some of the intro and conclusion will be the same, but the bulk of it will be different. And the way I'm going to do this is on Grace at the Gates, which is mostly PCA and NAPARC people, I'm going to have them talk about why they wrote the book in the context of, in the midst of us having Christian nationalism study committees in our denominations, but also what they thought of the PCA's study report on Christian nationalism. That will be on Grace at the Gates. On Eschatology Matters, we will go chapter by chapter through this book as they explain their political theology, which will be great for Eschatology Matters because they draw from a wide breadth of individuals, a big audience, everybody from people just learning about this stuff to experienced people in this conversation. And so this will be a real good exposure on Eschatology Matters, but also I think it fits well there. So that's going to be the difference. So you may hear some similarity in the episodes. Clearly, for continuity's sake, I have to put some of the parts in both, but the bulk of them will be different. And lastly, I'll say, is the audio quality. Well, the audio is not so bad. Really, the video quality is low res, and I hate that. But take it up with Mr. Christian Nationalism himself, Stephen Wolfe, and is, in his words, his country slow internet there. I mean, come on, if we're going to be in a Christian nation, can we at least get good internet across this country? But it wasn't able to render in high res, and that way, therefore, it didn't let us render any of our stuff in high res, and it was a mess. And so, forgive me for that. Without further ado, Reformed Christian Politics. Oh boy. We have, I was going to say the dynamic duo, but what's a trio called? But the authors of Reformed Christian Politics on Grace at the Gates. And this book's been out for about 6 months, and we finally get them on, and I'm sure it's going to be a doozy. So, gentlemen, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, George.
Yeah, thank you.
It's good to be here.
Yeah. So if you're not watching, if you're listening, we have Sean McGowan, Stephen Wolfe, and Zach Garris, two PCA pastors and one political philosopher. Is that what you call yourself, Stephen?
Yeah, I guess you're
you okay with that?
You know. Sure.
Okay. D.G. Hart called
Don't call me the philosopher.
Right. No. Yeah, I heard Hart on a podcast, maybe Sola Media, with Miles Smith, and he called you a philosopher. He actually wasn't antagonistic or rude toward you at all in that. So Zach gave me the book. I did read the PDF. I skim read it back when it came out. I read certain chapters and skim read a lot of it. And then Zach recently gave me this. He's been asking me to write a review, and I just don't write. I don't write much. I don't know how you guys sit down and write the way you do. I used to be able to do that. So I said, I'll have you on the podcast to discuss. And I got to say, as sort of an intro monologue, maybe, when it came out, I was very disinterested in it, which might be hard to believe because with all the episodes that I've done on the subject, I just was kind of burnt out on the topic. You know, I mean, I'm a pastor first, you know, and but concerned about NAPARC and the PCA and the tenor of the debates and the misunderstandings and the ungodly behavior from people who don't understand the conversation, quite frankly. And so that's what's engaged me. But when Sean gave it to me, I felt obligated. My brother's in the presbytery with me to to read it again. And I really couldn't put it down. So it's not common for me to read a book in less than a week, but basically I did. And I found it dense, but again, very engaging and very, not that it was an easy read. It was academic and tons of footnotes and all that, but just easy to read. And like I said, dense. And in that, the density of the material, like every sentence mattered, it seemed like, in every chapter, you know. So it's kind of impossible to discuss it comprehensively on here. So I want to get like sort of bigger themes and your purpose for this. So, and I've never had three guys on at a time. So maybe I'll call on you, but maybe just somebody speak up if I just ask an open-ended question or something. But how did you guys decide to write this, and when was that? What's the genesis of this book, and who wants to jump in on that? Go ahead, Zach. Well, I'm gonna have to cut out pauses.
So actually, I mean, I can even say for some of my chapters, I had been just keeping notes on, like, I had written some on R2K before, Reformed Two Kingdoms. I had been taking notes on theonomy, so. Spirituality of the Church, even, and some of that was from Sean and I working on our Southern Presbyterian book, and so we've been doing a lot of research and had a lot of stuff. So it's not like this just came out of nowhere, and Sean and I had been talking how it might be good to get some of this information out there, and then we ended up talking with Stephen, and so we just thought there was a lot of misinformation. I mean, you had Stephen's book, A Case for Christian Nationalism, but there were some other topics we wanted to fill in, and just with all the debates and knowing that there was the report coming in the PCA on Christian nationalism, we wanted to get some of our opinions out there, and thought, hey, we can contribute to the discussion. There's no reason we can't. And so we talked about that last year, and the project took us maybe, I don't know, maybe 9 months to finish. I'm not sure, but again, yeah, some of it was already going, and we just ended up discussing you know, a plan for putting something together, which is challenging with multiple authors, as you know, you may think. But
yeah, and you guys chose to keep the authors on the chapters, so readers can see who actually wrote a specific thing, right?
Yeah, and we talked about how to do that, because initially the report, when it was released as a PDF, did not delineate the authors. So that was that for the book it did. And so we had talked about how should we do this? You know, we wanted it to be like a unified whole, but because we went with the book route, which I think is great. I don't like reading PDFs. So we just decided it'd be good to have authorship there. So I don't know if anybody else wants to comment on that, but.
Well, I mean, yeah. I would say that there's obvious, like, a huge interest in Reformed political theology, political thought, and that's just reflected in the fact that the PCA had a commission study report committee? I don't know. Committee. And then, like, the OPC was talking about it, and then they just recently approved it. And then there's all sorts of things going around, and things going on under, like, the name of Christian nationalism. I just thought that, like, this was my opportunity to give like 50 pages of the sort of distinctions that I wish I had done originally in the older book. And so when people say, like, oh, I love Case for Christian Nationalism, but or I read it, I usually say, well, if you read chapter one, that's like the higher version of that book. Or if you're already really smart and educated, then just go straight to chapter one and don't read the Christian Nationalism book. But as I was thinking through, like, moving this project forward of really just Reformed political thought, this really wasn't so much a Christian nationalist report, because Sean and Zach don't really claim that label and probably don't like the word nationalism. I don't know if we've even talked about that before. So this is not really a Christian nationalist report. It's really a report on Reformed political thought. But as I thought through it, it's like Zach and Sean have a knowledge base or skill sets that I don't have. It's like, I don't know much about Southern Presbyterianism. I do like 17th century, you know, reform political thought and stuff in that era. And so I think I'm pretty good at that. And I know some things about modern two kingdoms or reformed two kingdoms, but Zach knows like the theology side really well. I kind of have my critiques. He knows the theology, biblical critique better than I do. So there was just a bunch of like complementary skill sets that when brought together, I think produced a pretty good treatment on these subjects, especially on the subjects and the topics that are of interest. Like Southern Presbyterianism actually is of interest now. And so bringing all that stuff together, Sean's chapter on that, I think it was very timely, and the topic choices were good. So I appreciate, George, that you read it. I appreciate you having us on to talk about it, and I hope it gets a wide reading.
Well, that's some of my hope for it, because there's, you know, there, for whatever reason, there's controversy around it, and we could talk about some of that, or there's just a people want to pretend like it doesn't exist. But, and it, like I said, when it came out, I was kind of burnt out on the whole topic, but reading it really, it was extremely well done. It wasn't ad hoc. It wasn't ad hominem. It was just well done and was honest. And when we talk about Sean's chapter, I want to talk some about that, because I think, as I've said online, it was just honest that there's, you know, there always has been a diversity of opinion on this. And yet R2K, as Zach's chapter says, you know, is a novel interpretation of the Noahic covenant, and that that really falls apart. But Sean, why was this a project of interest to you? I mean, I know you're interested in Southern Presbyterians and in political theology, but like, why was it important to put this together? I know your heart for the PCA. I know this is broader than the PCA, but you really wanted the PCA to read this. Why?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I echo everything that Stephen and Zach said. I think one of the things that comes out of this chapter, or this book, excuse me, is, you know, Stephen in his chapter talks a lot about permissible principles and prudential application, right? Something may be permissible in principle, but not prudential to apply given a particular, you know, the circumstance, context, people in place. And I think what you see as we work through this was those principles being applied to a particular place. So, you know, in our study of American Presbyterianism, I would not say that it's a repudiation of when it comes to the magistrate, it's a repudiation of those principles that we find in the 16th through the 18th centuries. But it's an adaptation of it. It's one example of prudentially applying these principles in a particular time and place. So, you know, for me, studying American Presbyterian history, particularly the Southern Presbyterians, you know, I realized really quickly, Zach and I both did, I think, that, you know, a lot of the stuff we hear about the magistrate today in the debates that were going on after Stephen's book was published, there's a wide variety of views in the Presbyterian church historically. But if you're listening to the debates, you know, you'd think there was only one view. And we really quickly realize, no, there is a variety here. I think there is some unity, but there's also a variety of opinions that are permissible to hold given our tradition and history. So, you know, through talking about that, through our writing with our Southern Presbyterian book and connecting with Stephen and his work, I just think our disciplines complemented one another. And I think, you know, the product speaks for itself. I think, a really good book came out of it. So that was my desire, just an interest in the discussion going on. And wanting to put our heads together and you know, put something out there that would continue that conversation.
What did you think of the overture that named your book to try to append it to the study committee report. Did you have a hand in that, Sean?
Did I have a hand in that? No, not directly. No. Of course, you know, I think me and Zach, or I think all of us maybe know who did it. You know, we know the minister who did it, good guy. But yeah, you know, I thought it was just going to be, you know, taken an omnibus and, you know, that was all that was going to happen. I think, you know, at least in our section, when we were sitting in the assembly hall, I think you could probably hear a pin drop when that minister stood up and said, "I'd like to pull 90 from the omnibus." We didn't know where that was going to go. So
that's hilarious. Yeah. Stephen, what is your interest? I mean, you're not a pastor, obviously. I mean, I understand your career or calling interest in this, but what's your interest for NAPARC? You do seem, whereas NAPARC has, especially establishment NAPARC, has definitely not been friendly to you. What's your heart for our communion of churches? You know, Zach, Sean, and myself are all PCA pastors, and you clearly partnered with them in this.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, my main concern is not with the churches as churches or NAPARC as NAPARC. I am interested in the discussion around political thought, and not only at the level of philosophy, but also at the level of practice. And so that intersects with the churches. So I think that, so it's kind of like it's not so much I'm interested in the PCA as the PCA, I'm interested in people in the PCA who are commenting on politics. Because I've said many times, I don't expect like pastors to be the politicians. I expect the politicians to be under pastors. And so I'm interested in the church because I want our statesmen to be in good churches. But I leave it to guys who are churchmen to deal with the church as church. So I'm really just interested in the political thought as it in terms of the philosophy and the practice and how it intersects with the church itself.
Okay. And theologically, you are a Presbyterian, right? I mean,
yeah, right. Yeah.
So we would be the natural sort of audience for a lot of this stuff. This hasn't been well received by establishment type people. You know, again, the common people are reading it and stuff. But within NAPARC, where do you think that backlash is coming from? And do you see it, or am I reading something that's not there?
I don't know if it's backlash. I mean, maybe there's some of that, but you know, it's common for folks just to ignore things like this. But I'm not sure it's about even qualifications or anything. I mean, Stephen has a PhD; he's known, but he's kind of outside of the established, academia, which would also be true of Sean and myself. We don't have PhDs. I do have a law degree, but I'm not sure anybody cares about that. So that's partly my interest with government and the like, but, I think it's not just the PCA or NAPARC, but I've just found this in general with kind of Christian academics they just don't want to always hear from everybody. I've seen that maybe with some of my writings on, men and women but this is not entirely true with social media and like kind of the younger generation. They're very much interested in things that Stephen's written, of course, and I would say also true of my writings. And so it's only certain people that ignore it. But you can only ignore it for so long. And I think that's kind of our thought is we didn't write this just for this year. I mean, this book was to give information and principles and teachings for the future of the church.
Yeah. Okay. Either of you guys have any thoughts on that?
I think my default is just to sort of ignore things. And that's kind of a tactic. And that is a good tactic. But then you ignore hoping to defeat it in the long run. And I don't think that strategy has worked. I think in the long run, as we continue to produce work and make arguments, we are influencing people, but it's largely kind of behind the scenes because the institutional power makes it difficult for you to be publicly align or publicly state certain ideas. So you could have the most brilliant argument or the soundest argument possible, and you could say it with the most respect as possible. But the fact that you hold that idea, or even dare to present that idea, clashes with the desires of the institution for itself. And so I think at this point, what we're seeing is kind of sort of tactical institutional pressure to suppress certain ideas. And that's kind of where I think the battle is now. It's trying to, because now everything is kind of so decentralized, and it's harder to gatekeep in terms of ideas presented in the public. And so now you have to scramble to kind of gatekeep at the level of institution, who's respectable, who's not, and wield that power against people. And so I think many people have chosen not to refute, because when you refute, then you're actually giving, in some sense, the guy legitimacy, like you're legitimizing that this argument is worthy of your time to refute. I think that's why, how do I say this? That's why I think like Kevin DeYoung has focused his energy on like refuting Doug Wilson and not me, which I don't want to go too far into that, but it's interesting when he tries to refute Christian nationalism, he attacks Doug Wilson and doesn't mention me at all. So I think there's a sort of tactical move in all of that, and that's what we're seeing. But we're just going to kind of continue kind of try to influence and present arguments out and do the best thing we can, like the most rigorous arguments we can, and try to influence people at that level. So,
Sean?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, my experience has been, yeah, there have been people, particularly online, that just kind of written it off, or, you know, they attack us for our association, you know. I think early on there was a lot of, excitement negatively over the fact that two PCA ministers formally wrote a book with He Who Shall Not Be Named, Stephen Wolfe. So, there was a lot of that, you know, but over time, I think people actually read the work. And, I know Zach and Stephen can attest to this. We had guys coming up to us at the General Assembly saying, you know, we've been reading your book. We love your book. We're thankful for what y'all are doing. Young guys, you know, that are under care in presbyteries, or, you know, want to come under care and want to serve as ministers in the PCA. I had a couple groups of PCA guys come up to me at the assembly saying, you know, we're doing a book study, you know, two or three ministers are getting together, reading through the book. So, you know, I think there are obviously going to be people that dismiss it, write us off, but, you know, there is a younger generation that is not doing that. And they're reading our work, and they're, you know, they appreciate what we're doing. So that motivates me, and I'm sure it motivates Zach and Stephen as well to continue to write and do what we do. So.
Yeah, I mean, I can't count how many people have either come up to me at GA or messaged me and thanked me for, like, giving Stephen a hearing. And I'm like, well, who am I to give Stephen a hearing? I'm a nobody. But the fact that, like, it's, again, He Who Shall Not Be Named, and I was, you know, willing to have you on, was meaningful to those guys you're talking about, Sean. I think some of this is like, look, the people that are going to be detractors are going to be detractors anyway. They don't like what you're doing. They don't like the implications of it. But I do think at times, particular with the controversies that you guys have found yourself in, you guys find that in trying to cast a wide net for your ideas, it ends up like sabotaging you in other circles?
No, I think some people will, you know, use associations against us, or myself in particular. And so, I think it's good to be cautious with those things, but there are challenges, because, you know, I do consider myself fairly ecumenical in the good sense. Obviously that term can be used negatively, but, outside of like our confessional bounds, like working within the institutional church, the PCA, I think it's good to work broadly, whether it's more conservative circles or progressive or whatever it is. So in some ways I'll kind of speak to, in a sense, whoever will have me, though I have to exercise wisdom there and act accordingly with if certain certain things happen. But yeah, I think most people will still give us a hearing. I think most people are reasonable, but there's obviously some detractors who are not, and they just don't care what we do. So,
okay, Stephen, do you want to speak?
I'll just speak to myself and not to anyone else here. But I mean, The Case of Christian Nationalism was a canon book. Okay, so you already know that the audience is not your typical NAEPARC guy, and I didn't know what was going to happen when I published the book. Of course, everyone who writes a book hopes that some movement sparks out of it. And something kind of did spark out of the book, and it was a movement. It was largely very populist. It still is populist, meaning that it's not people in the institutions who are adopting these ideas. So in that way, it's different than the sort of post-liberal Catholic integralism. This is far more populist. Now, I wanted to transition out of populism, but when you enter into like a populist space, there are challenges there, because now it's a sort of free for all. Who's going to take the label Christian nationalist? Who's going to run with this idea, but then add this other idea to it that I may not agree with? And so it becomes a lot more challenging, because I don't go into this actually wanting to influence a bunch of like highbrow people who aren't going to do anything. Like, I actually want things to change. So that requires elites, of course, but also requires just influence. And so when you try to navigate in those dynamics, it becomes very challenging, because you do have people, like I said, who take positions you don't agree with, but you're also trying to influence people. And so if you're constantly doing this kind of like whack-a-mole thing, like some guy pops up, whack, and then another thing pops up, and you're constantly doing this, meanwhile, the people who really don't like you, for whatever reason, are now kind of like using that against you and trying to split and divide. And I think if people understood that when you're in that world, there are going to be times where you become associated with a guy where you're like, I wish that didn't actually happen, or I wish that guy wouldn't say that. But then you also realize that, how are you going to influence the people he is influencing? You know, how are you going to maintain that relationship with those people and try to pull them out of that? And so things become very challenging when you're in that world. Like, if you're just simply academic writing like a book on metaphysics, yeah, you care a lot about what other metaphysicians in the highbrow space care about. I don't care as much about that at this point, or at least I haven't for the last few years. That's kind of vague, but I think that just try to explain to people that when you actually want to move towards something and it requires this very decentralized open space, you have to, there are going to be landmines, there are problems, there are associations, there are these various attacks you're going to suffer through, and you just have to kind of do the best you can in trying to move it forward. And that takes sometimes people accusing you of being this or that. And I've been accused of everything, from communist to Nazi. I've been accused of everything. Okay. it's challenging. But then, yeah, that's just for speaking for myself. And it's a challenging world out there.
Yeah, no doubt. And you've been, I haven't known you that long, but I spoke to you early last fall, and on private conversations, you said very similar, just about the casting the wide net, being able to influence people of different views while not necessarily holding them. And I think, as I said earlier, I think detractors are going to detract anyway. What I tell people, I was called a fool online. That's nothing new, I guess. But for saying the way these debates originated in the PCA, they didn't originate around race, ethnicity, all this stuff. It was originally two and a half years ago, a post-mill, a-mill debate. And I proved that, because all the articles that were being written, whether it was Kevin DeYoung or the American Reformer stuff going back and forth, was all around 1646 versus 1788 standards, when guys were coming to the floor of GA or to the committees, they were talking about like post-mill as the scary thing or theonomy. Like the race piece didn't get interjected in until later. Now, I'm not saying it wasn't there, clearly. I mean, like, you know, the Corey Mahlers and that world and Spengler pre-existed this stuff. And that was, it was there, but that wasn't the predominant thing. And I think my point in bringing this up is, I think the bad actors, when it comes to various race-based views of this, are tainting the movement and y'all's work. Since you brought up the PCA report, what are some thoughts on that, Sean or Zach, as PCA pastors?
Yeah, so I guess I'll my own here. Yeah. Yeah, I want to be careful with commenting too much before the release of the full report.
You're keeping it close to your chest.
No. I was going to say I at least supported your substitute on the assembly floor, George. I still don't really understand why we voted to commend the report to the church when apparently there's going to be some changes and apparently there's some errors in it and things like that. So I do have concerns, but I do want to wait to see when the full report is released. I think probably one of my biggest ones, we've already brought it up, was, you know, I think it's page 2709, you know, going back to 23:3, they say one of the magistrate's duties, the magistrate's posture toward false religion does not include exclusion from public office. And I just, you know, not to rehash everything we said, I just think that that's not a prima facie reading from 23:3. I don't think you find that in there. But also I think it's inconsistent with the practice of many of the men that were on the revision committee and what they did when they also had a hand in the formation of state constitutions. I hope that's changed. I hope they take that out. Because I think that is one problem that I came across when I was reading it.
You know, and to that point, an ongoing concern I have with the report in general is it makes statements like that. And again, the Westminster Standards is supposed to be our doctrinal statement. You know, this is not like supposed to be, you know, a contextual statement. The Westminster Standards is, this is what we believe the Bible teaches on these things. And so when the report makes statements like that, that saying that Westminster 23 is forbidding this, can we actually say that doctrinally the Bible is forbidding that? And so I think what they're doing is they're applying our American political context or the standards to our American political context and saying that's what it means or teaches. And I think an argument nobody has really made, I've said it a couple times myself, but is, I mean, it might be considered, there could be a Romans 13 argument to say, well, this is what respecting our government, this is our government, so we're going to respect these things, while also saying, but scripture allows for more. But the report doesn't even really kind of touch on these issues in those ways. It kind of takes our, and I know, Stephen, you say this quite a bit, you know, it takes our political order and makes that the doctrinal position, which is kind of backwards.
Yeah. I mean, also I would say, you know, just coming back to that point in the report that I at least take issue with, you know, they're, this is a committee of the PCA and they're interpreting 23:3 to essentially say that it's not permissible for the magistrate to exclude, you know, false religions, people that hold to false religions from civil office. So does that mean that if you have a PCA minister who believes that in principle it is permissible for the magistrate to say, you know, we're going to have a religious test, so unless you profess the Protestant faith, you cannot hold civil office. If a minister believes that the magistrate has, at least it's permissible for the magistrate to do that, are they violating the revised Westminster Confession of Faith, at least according to the PCA? I just, I get concerned. Well,
the,
when The report we have these interpretations, that are clearly not warranted from the text, at least in my opinion.
Well, I mean, the answer to your question is yes. The report concludes you are at odds, and you would need to declare that as a difference. I mean, that's what's said over and over, and that's my argument why I don't think we should have sent it down for consideration and use, is because we haven't adjudicated that. We haven't debated that. We haven't really even approved that, but yet we're telling press releases, well, go ahead and use this thing. And you know, it's already been shown how that was taken. So there was that Tennessean article. I think you guys weighed in, with that reporter, but you know, major U.S. denomination or Presbyterian denomination, you know, denounces Christian nationalism, the first one. And I'm like, well, the report doesn't denounce Christian nationalism. It denounces certain aspects that, some things I would even agree with. But it doesn't denounce Christian nationalism. And then the other one was, there was an AI chart that's been going around that says the PCA report denounces Christian nationalism for all these reasons, and it doesn't. And so there's all this miscommunication because we essentially sent something down as a de facto adoption, and we didn't adopt it. So I think that was a mistake, and I think it's going to be harder for them to clean it up because it's already been out there. So,
yeah, if I could comment.
Yeah.
George, I do think I was reading the report last night. I think there's much good, but I also think that there's enough errors, and I would say overstatements, that I think the report is a problem. And so, some of my thought is, it's one thing to say here's some different views, but it's clearly somewhat aggressive as far as like, well, if you hold this, you need to state a difference. It's the opinion of the committee. You need to state a difference to your presbytery. And I think, especially when I read that and I go, I don't agree with that. And I think if they're taking an incorrect position, that is not good for the peace of the church, right? To say you need to state a difference on something that you actually don't need to state a difference on. If their opinion is contrary to fact and truth, then this is a problem. And so I think the committee should be cautious here, and my hope is that they will actually scale some of these recommendations back. Let me give some examples. Sean mentioned the one about public office. I mean, that just goes against the practice of the states in 1788, so that's a huge problem, where they limited office holders often to Trinitarians or, you know, something like that. There's even a denial about the right of the Christian magistrate to disenfranchise the citizens on the basis of religion. I just don't think voting rights is something we should even be getting into. That just seems beyond the purview of the American confession. I think you pointed this one out on X, George. It's the eighth denial. We deny the Ordo Amoris provides a warrant for the preferential treatment of one's own ethnic group ahead of any other. Of course, it depends how we define ethnicity, but if you go with Stephen's definition, that would refer to, say, Americans. So we can't preference Americans over non-Americans. I mean, what, is that trying to wade into immigration or something? I mean, that's a huge problem.
So camp there for a sec. So the, I've leaned into my Arab identity for this, and because as an Arab, I can say these things, and nobody, you know, challenges, you know, what are viewed as ethnic minorities in saying these things, whether they be African Americans or Hispanics or Arabs or Asians, that you clearly can show, these groups clearly can show a preference for their people in various ways that I've already given. And in the example in the tweet, I even used like the Italian American Association giving scholarships to Italians, as like that would be a violation of what this report says, because you have people there clearly giving preference, and I don't know how you can say they're not doing that on the basis of Ordo Amoris. So the report goes beyond what scripture says. I think it goes beyond in these areas. I mean, there's so much to commend about the report, and honestly, with a few tweaks, I'd be fine with it. But just to kind of affirm, you know, what you're saying there, Zach.
Yeah. So, I mean, we can come back to this, but some of this gets into the spirituality of the church. So as if the report is making affirmations and condemnations beyond scripture, then I think that's a problem. I don't think the church should be doing that, not in a church capacity. And this is absolutely what the church, this would fall under the spirituality of the church. This would be a statement by a church body, the General Assembly.
Well, even the statement, I don't know if you're going to get to it, about like that biological descent doesn't confer political legitimacy. Like, could we really say that? I mean, we could say what we want or what we think America is, but would we impose that upon other nations? Then other nations don't have a right to determine political legitimacy based on who you're born to, or
yeah,
born to a citizen. I mean, I don't.
I agree. That's just something that shouldn't be weighed into by the church. I mean, there's going to be variation. I mean, and that's something, you know, we say is there's variation of views, and some of these things are not, you know, some of these things are American. They're not necessarily Christian, and other nations are going to operate differently, and that's okay. One other thing I noticed that, you know, there is the affirmation 9 on men and male and female. Didn't say anything about civil government except in the denial, you know. And so I just am like, why is there a need to even speak to this, where it says we deny that cultural anxieties or social change justify profane speech or contempt for women? Okay, but I mean, what about contempt for men? I mean, we have that too in our culture. So why is this just towards women? Affirming complementarity does not preclude women's participation in education, civic life, or public service. Again, I mean, I would say either take a more biblical reform position or just don't touch it. So I would just say drop this. Why is the PCA even trying to speak to such a matter in this report?
Especially with a broad brush. I mean, that, to me, that's the bigger point. I mean, that debate would take pages, and just to have a flat denial on something with zero nuance or understanding, it does seem to violate the bounds of the report and the spirituality of the church.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It's something I just don't think should be in here, and is more troublesome, because of it. I noted a couple other things, where it said the 1788 American Revision, an officer who believes that the civil magistrate has the duty to suppress heresies. And then it lists some other things. It says that this is in directly contrary to the confession as adopted by the PCA. And then they say the magistrate may not, quote, in the least interfere in matters of faith. Now, I think that's getting at the concerning in the church. I don't think so. So I think they're misreading that. They're saying that basically the state can't prohibit blasphemy, like, at all, or something like that. And I think that's wrong. I think that's a misreading. And in fact, that could be even prohibiting Sabbath laws based on their reading. So I think that's incorrect.
So what I would say to listeners trying to understand this, like, so much of what I see in the debate is just a complete misunderstanding of how this works. And I think this first chapter really kind of lays out the categories you need to be able to think through this, you know, because like some of the arguments you hear against, you know, what you guys are saying and believing is like, well, you can't force belief, or you can't force faith, or, you know, you can't legislate the heart. And none of you are saying any of those things. You know, there's not a category for like the ordering of society to the good. Zach had a great quote on that. I was trying to see if I could find it about, well, the state's not redemptive, it can order, it orders things to the redemptive, or something like that. Zach, do you remember? I'm sure you don't know that specific line, but
that sounds about right. So again, we're not necessarily advocating that our current civil government suppress heresies, but we do leave room for it in principle. So anyway, there's things like that I read throughout the report, and I'm like, that needs cleaned up. It's too narrow of a reading, or too aggressive as far as what it's trying to say is outside of the American standards.
Yeah.
So I'll speak for myself. I know you guys are all in the PCA. I think the report's kind of a disaster. I mean, I was expecting, well, not expecting, given the composition, all sorts of, like, you know, degrees of the committee, I was hoping, you know, that there would be something a little more, a little better, a little more restraint. I know in the end, like, the argument's going to be, well, that's, this is like the opinion of the committee. But as a very famous Presbyterian once said, recently passed, he said, it's not what you say, it's what you do when you say it, or something to that effect. That was Tim Keller. And I think that the way that this is going to operate is that this is going to be adopted literally adopted, and not simply just received. I think it's going to be, I'm not saying officially, formally adopted. I don't even know how that, all that stuff works, but it's going to be kind of received as, like, this is our PCA political theology. And it makes very specific claims that I think, in effect, maybe not in, like, stated principle, it could be a sort of ecclesiastical tyranny, not only over ministers, but also over laymen. Because I think as what has been stated by all you guys is that there, throughout this, there's like the essentially requiring people to take exceptions to things that clearly are not in the text. And then there are opinions about certain ideas from ethno-nationalism and things related to that, that it's not clear to me how you get that from the confession. I'd have to see the argument. Like, ethno-nationalism could be wrong, it could be immoral, but is it wrong on the basis of the confession? Is it wrong on the basis of theology, or is it wrong on the basis of politics or some biblical argument? So you'll have to actually see what the argument is. I just think it's best that if there's going to be a committee like this, they should say more of, like, what is permitted for people to affirm in a sort of broad sense, so that then people can debate within those parameters. But the way that is presented now, there isn't so much to debate on the in-betweens. It's either you are a moderate Republican, or you're maybe a sort of lighthearted MAGA guy, or maybe you're a moderate Blue Dog Democrat. Like, the range of acceptable opinions have been narrowed down into modern liberalism, where now it's just a sort of debate over, like, healthcare policy and really nothing else. Like, that's just my reading of it. It's just really it's unwarranted by the confession. I'm not even sure that, like, the church itself as church has the competence to make certain judgments here. It sounds as if, like, the church is making judgments on behalf of the state that are really for the state to decide, like, who has the right to vote, like, who can enter into the country. Like, is now, like, if Japan becomes Christian, now all of a sudden they have to be multicultural to meet the demands of the gospel? Or, like, now Hungary has to receive all sorts of foreigners into its country? Things that are really political questions are being decided by an ecclesiastical body. And it's just, I think it's overreach, and it should not be. Like, and the other thing is, a lot of these things should now be, they should be open for debate. But now when this is adopted, it's now the reference is to the document and its statements and its affirmations and denials, which often are not arguments. They're just statements of, we affirm this, we affirm that. I mean, sometimes there's mixtures of, like, reasons in there. But so I don't like it. Speaking for myself, I just don't think it's very good.
Well, and you you said the word ethno-nationalism, and so now you've given everybody you've baited everybody, but, like, you referenced Japan and Hungary. So are those examples of an ethno-nationalist countries?
Yeah, I would say so. And I don't have any, like, if, again, I don't have any problem. If I wanted to move to Japan and they said, hey, you can't go because you're not Japanese, like, yeah, that's your political decision.
And that, right? And that's my
America,
issue.
Like, it,
good.
Like, America is a special, America is a case where, yes, there is ethnic diversity, but it's still a political question. Right. It's just like for Japan, if Japan chooses for more immigration because of its low birth rates, that's a political decision. It's not a theological, you know, dictum. Right. So it should be in the realm of politics, not ecclesiastical, you know, dicta. And so that's how I take it. And same with like the Hungarians don't want to import, a horde of Middle Easterners. That's perfectly within their,
What do you got
their
against my
political
brothers, man?
prerogative.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Yeah.
No, I agree wholeheartedly. I agree wholeheartedly. So, yes, and that's my main like overarching issue is the report takes our political arrangement and makes that theological doctrine. And I just don't think you can do that. And that's not how I, as a minister who have to subscribe to the standards, view the standards. I don't view the standards as this is the scriptural truth for America. This is what the Bible teaches for all peoples of all places and times, and our theology needs to accommodate that. And the report doesn't seem to. But I'm more optimistic about the report than your assessment of it. Of course, I'm not a political philosopher. I think there's a few. There, if they cleaned up a couple of things, I think I could be good with it and live with it. So, just to kind of. Let's conclude here. I've never really done a 2-hour episode. Try to keep them to half this. So I hope this has been interesting to people. I appreciate you guys' time. What is like your and Sean, you wrote the concluding chapter, but again, everybody, just some concluding thoughts for your hope for this work. And again, for some of the history of it, it started as a PDF. Then you actually got it published, and you've been giving them away because you got donors to help with that. And I understand too, you helped clarify certain things. There's a few differences, particularly maybe in your chapter, Stephen, of further clarification you offered on certain things. But at the end of the day, what's your hope for this work? And yeah, maybe even the future of NAEPARC on these issues.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll go. I mean, the concluding chapter I did write. I don't even know if it's is the last chapter or just the additional conclusion. I don't know. The conclusion is a separate thing in itself. I mean, I basically summarized the book and what we've said, and also gave some application for the church. One of the applications was acknowledging that those advocating for a Christian nation or promotion of Christianity by public officials, they're actually advocating for the normative position in the Reformed and Presbyterian tradition. And because of that, it's a permissible position to adopt. And I discussed that a little bit. I think one of the things that I do mention that I think is important, and George and I were having a conversation about this the other day. There still seems to be a lot of misunderstanding about what those advocating for, the government promoting true religion or even Christian nationalism, whatever you want to call it, is this idea that really the church is going to take over the government kind of mentality. I mean, it's very simplistic, obviously very wrong, but there's a lot of people that still seem to think that's what we're advocating, or others that are pushing for this are advocating. So one of the last applications that I say is to recognize that finally recognize the jurisdiction of elders is limited to the church, and that ministers have a particular duty to teach God's word and administer the sacraments. My point being that ministers have a particular calling. We're not the politicians. We're not going to be the ones that are advocating public policy or whatever, but we are, teaching the principles of what's permissible from scripture, from our tradition, things like that. But our primary duty as ministers is to administer the heavenly things, to minister to the souls. So I think that's important for people to recognize, is that we are not saying that, we as ministers should be the ones that are running the government, or really, the ones involved in, public policy, crafting it or whatever. We want to administer to the people's needs, administer to their souls, and also allow for, political theorists and politicians to do the work of politics. But we're speaking on the principles, and one of the principles is that the government ought to promote true religion. So, but I think that's important for people to understand, is that we're not advocating for Christian pastors to run the government or things of that nature. We believe that as ministers, our primary calling is to administer the Word of God and the sacraments. Hope for the PCA, or I'll just, you know, you said NAPARC, I'll just say PCA. I'll just say, speaking for myself, I love the PCA. You know, Zach and I just finished writing nearly 1,000 pages on the Southern Presbyterian Church, which obviously the PCA was formed out of that. So I'm deeply grateful for the tradition of the PCA. I'm grateful for some of the men. I mean, I think you know, the fact that, you know, Fred Greco was just elected the stated clerk, I think that's a wonderful thing, and I think it signals a good direction for the church. I'm also thankful, mentioned this, for a lot of the young men that have come up to us and reached out to us in the PCA that are thankful for our work. You know, all three of us, I think, have been encouraged by that in many respects. But there are still concerns. I have a lot of concerns. You know, we've claimed to do away with the side B and the woke controversies in the PCA that were in the teens and the early 2020s. And yet we still have men in our denomination that have endorsed those controversies. They're continuing to serve in our churches and in our ministries. We obviously haven't dealt with the FFO, the functional female officers controversy, which we saw has affected a lot of our churches. I know there's differences of opinion and how to deal with that. So I do hope that our presbyteries will take a stronger stance against that. And we'll see some clarity on that. You know, I have concerns with how some, obviously, in the PCA have reacted to our book and kind of, you know, the reform political thought in general. And maybe I'm alone on this, but I also think that there is something to be said about being too big as a church. We are a denomination that extends, you know, beyond the continental United States, even into different countries. And I do think that regional differences can affect how we minister together. I think maybe a lot of people don't want to acknowledge that, but it's true. You know, Archibald Alexander had a great quote when he discussed the Presbyterian Church in his day in 1836, he said that the church was too large, too widely extended, and too heterogeneous to be under one ecclesiastical regimen. And I think there's something to that. But all that to say, you know, that was a long-winded answer. You know, I do love the PCA. I want to see her honor Christ. I want to see her be faithful to her standards. But we certainly have some work to do. So.
All right.
That's my thoughts.
Yeah, Zach?
yeah, I'll just some small things to add. I do hope our book, you know, helps kind of give some grounding for you know, historic Presbyterian views on civil government. So, but even the work Sean and I do in general are more of our historical work on Southern Presbyterians that'll be coming out. I'm just hoping we can return the PCA and NAPARC in general, but especially the PCA, can return to its you know, historic Reformed or Presbyterian roots, and not just assume kind of modern views, whether it's modern political liberalism or you know, egalitarianism when it comes to gender issues. So I'd like to see, and maybe this is a word of encouragement to older brethren, is I'd like to see us not attack young men on the right, whether it's political, culturally, theologically, whatever you want to call it. We need to welcome those men. I mean, all of us here, I think, would consider ourselves on the right in some capacity. We need to welcome those men. There's, of course, some sins, you know, of all groups. You know, we want to watch our speech. And, you know, I know that's always a thing people are concerned about online. But we want to foster godliness. It is possible to be right wing and be godly. And that's, I think, what we want to model, what we want to push. At least I'm speaking for myself here. And so we shouldn't be attacking young men. Look, this is the way America's going. I think, at least a lot of the young men. And so Nate Park would, I think, be doing a great disservice to itself if it does what I'm warning against, which is attacking young men on the right. You will drive them away and you will hurt our churches. And so we should not be doing that. We can have various, you know, political views and whatnot within our churches, you know, except we don't want those that are contrary to, you know, the explicit teaching of Scripture and our theological standards. But we shouldn't be reactionary against the right. And we should instead seek to foster godliness, set an example for such. But another thing I'll say there is, we should target the you know, I think true threats to the church, which would be things like functional female officers, egalitarianism, and the like. Those are true threats to the PCA. But another thing, maybe more specific to our work, Reformed Christian Politics, would be. We want to encourage political involvement, not of the church as an institution, but individuals. I think it's good for young men in our churches to get politically active and involved, maybe to become magistrates. You know, I'd love to see more Presbyterian, you know, senators and presidents and things like that. We just don't do that anymore. That's our old practice, and we've gotten really bad there. So I'd like to see more of that.
Thanks. Yeah. Stephen, final words.
Yeah, I'll just say that this work, like, we tried to make this as serious as possible. So, you know, we went into this saying this is going to be as, like, the most rigorous possible defense of our thesis and our various kind of sub-theses. And I think we really accomplished that. The case for Christian nationalism was kind of trollish in places, I admit that. I mean, it went through canon and it was whatever. I won't get into that too much, but this book is not that. I mean, my chapter, like the summary chapter, is a little bit expressed my frustrations with things. But like overall, it's a very like serious book. And it's not, I think it's a sort of book, like we want to write a book that would have to be refuted. And not simply like stylistically challenged. Like there's a difference here. Like some people write in a way that doesn't really prove their conclusion, but it's clever. And so the way to refute it is to be clever back. And what we did here is not try to be stylistically clever, but actually make a substantive argument. And so what I would hope is that people would read it, and if they don't agree, that they would reply in a way that would be substantive refutation. I know it's kind of dense and difficult at times, but I totally welcome that. And that just hasn't happened much, not only with this book so far, but also with other arguments that we've made in other places. So I would hope that would happen. And I would encourage anyone who disagrees with us to try to do that. I mean, you can debate us on YouTube or, you know, write something. Because we really tried to make a serious contribution to the discussion. And I think together we did. And I'm very proud of what we put together. So I'll just leave it at that. Please refute us. Go for it.
Yeah. Without ad hominem. And that's, you know, kind of my project or whatever this is, the last year has just been to give voice to people's views. Because the thing that frustrates me the most online is the ad hominem attacks and the mischaracterization of people's views rather than actual refuting of or engaging them. And I've taken heat for it. Maybe not the same heat as you guys, but like, why are you interviewing this guy or that guy? And like I've said, almost everybody I've interviewed, I've had somebody question why I would do such a thing. But I just believe people should be treated fairly. And so I do, I'm glad I read it, even though, like I said, I was burnt out on the topic. I'm glad I read it, and it did, I think it accomplished what you want. So that's what I hope it does. I hope it does that. Well, anyway, this has been a marathon, not quite a Rogan, but long for me for sure. So I appreciate you, men, and thank you for coming on.
Thanks, George.
Yeah. Thank you for having us on.
Thanks,
yeah.
George.
Yeah, you're welcome. Oh, and then if you're still listening, like, subscribe to the channel. I'm like 100 subscribers from 1,000, which, you know, in Stephen Wolf's world is nothing, but to me that would help with promotion. So yeah, subscribe and share. Thanks for watching Grace at the Gates.
The training of the next generation of pastoral leaders is of vital importance. The problem is that seminary is oftentimes incredibly expensive. You have to uproot your family. You have to go to another place where you're not plugged into a local church. What BTS does is it provides a way for people to continue in their hometown, continue in their present ministry, gain the tools that they need for pastoral leadership, be equipped for the work of the ministry for the long haul, and do it inexpensively but substantively. I love that about Birmingham Theological Seminary.